it please the Court, Tom Durkin on behalf of Mr. Sklina. My colleague John Klein from San Francisco was actually the lead counsel on the brief. He apologizes for not being able to be here today. I'm sorry he's not here because he's a lot smarter than I am. But he had another matter in San Francisco that he could not avoid. I did try the case, however, and I'm quite familiar with the case. In order to understand this tortured case from my perspective, I think some background is appropriate. This case started out, the trades took place in 2004. Subsequent to that, there was a full-blown office of the audits and inspector office of inspector general, or the office of audit, something like that, at the Board of Trade. In that whole hearing, which was an evidentiary hearing, Mr. Sklina was only given a suspension of a few days or weeks, I'm not sure exactly, a fine.
60 days, yeah.
There was 60 days?
I think so.
And there was a fine, but no restitution. One of the most interesting parts about that, I thought, is that no customer ever complained about the fill, to use the parlance of the pits, that they got in that. The CFTC then got involved and filed a civil case in January of 2008. That's where Mr. Sarvi's testimony was taken in a civil deposition. The indictment in this case was not brought until the last day of the statute of limitations, March 31st, 2009. Mr. Sarvi had given a deposition in the CFTC case on November 12th of 2008, and some 9 months after the indictment is returned, Sarvi dies.
So can I ask you whether in the CFTC case, fines or restitution or monetary relief of some type is on the table?
I believe there are many things on the table we set forth in our brief.
Right. I'm just trying, because in this case, so, Mr. Sklina is given a a forfeiture order, right, of $2 million and something.
That's right.
Right. And so there's trying to figure out money to money here.
My understanding is there's a civil penalty. There's disgorgement available. It's similar to the SEC proceedings, as I understand it. And there's injunctive relief. Disgorgement, civil penalty.
You can end a career, right?
I'm sorry?
You can end a career.
And
yes,
you can end a career.
Absolutely.
So the reason I'm asking that question, of course, goes to the 804 issue about motive. You know, is the incentive of the government in the CFTC proceeding sufficiently great to align it with the incentive in a proceeding like this one?
Well, and I think it clearly is. Which takes us to the Burge. I wasn't going to get there that quickly, but it's exactly the same argument the government took in the Burge case in their pleading. I don't know that it's worth reading to you, but I think some of the things are amazing. I mean, they just come right out and say it doesn't matter whether it's a civil case. I mean, they if you read the Burge pleadings, which are attached as in numbers 18 and 19, to our supplemental appendix, you would think that was our pleading. I've never been in a case like this where I could cite to you the government's own pleadings that support our position, and yet they take the exact opposite position in this case.
Well, see, here's what I think might conceivably have interest. Suppose in the CFTC proceeding there was no possibility of money. What it reminds me of a bit is situations where you might use offensive issue preclusion. And if the stakes in proceeding number one are very low and the stakes in proceeding number two are very high, you would reject offensive issue preclusion because the incentives to litigate are just too different. Here, it looks to me like the government's incentive to litigate, as you suggest, is actually quite similar. No prison time for the CFTC.
That's exactly the position they take. We pointed out in our brief, when the CFTC, which I call the government there as well, filed their motion to stay in front of Judge Kendall, they said it was exactly the same issues. Everything was the same. And, in fact, if I read the government's brief correctly, all the government says is the only difference between the civil case in terms of the facts and the issues is the difference between proving the wire, whether it was wire fraud, which I submit, and we said in our reply, is a preposterous distinction.
But to take the government side now for a second, it seems to me their concern is, you know, here Sarvi has gone, moved on, right? So he's not available for cross-examination.
About as unavailable as one could be,
exactly.
I think.
I'm assuming that.
As far as I know, at least. Yeah.
So there are these critical facts that Sarvi's earlier account presents in a light favorable to Mr. Sklena. Like, when did the trades, is it 7:31 in the morning or is it 7:37 in the morning? And was I trading on my own account or was I trading for in my capacity as a broker? I mean, these are critical issues. And the prosecutor from the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't have any chance to cross-examine Mr. Sarvi. He's done.
But in order... I don't think it should matter whether it's the prosecutor or not. The CFTC lawyer had the very same motive. They have to prove the same thing. If they couldn't prove in the CFTC case that these trades took place at 7:37 or whenever they say it did, they couldn't prove it in the criminal case any more than they could prove it in the civil case. So
your position that the cross-examination was vigorous enough to allow us, I mean, or it's the kind of cross-examination, I guess I'll put it this way, the evidence rules contemplate for something that would come in under this exception.
Absolutely, although I think
the argument could be made that the difference is the CFTC doesn't have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, so maybe they don't have to tear down adverse witnesses as completely as in a criminal case.
But the question is not so much whether they did or whether they decided to do. The question was they could have. I mean, you would never be able to get it in if that were the test. I mean, the cases, it seemed to me, on motives.
I'm just asking the question whether the fact that the incentive to engage in really vicious cross-examination might be less in the CFTC ought to weigh in the judgment whether to allow it to be used in a criminal case.
Well, then I don't know what the government's going to say in the Burge case, because in Burge, where it was similar, and even less similar, I would submit, they still say that the cross-examination motives were still the same, even though there was only his job and money were at stake. I think that's a distinction without a difference. I understand what you're saying. Is a criminal prosecutor literally going to prosecute better? Maybe. Maybe not. I've seen some pretty bad government cross-examination. On the other hand, the motive of the CFTC has got to be the same, because the whole issue...
Well, I understand the motive. Yeah, I just question it.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, Mr. Durkin, what concerns me most about your side of this argument is that this is a bench trial, and the trier of fact has said, in essence, I don't think much of Mr. Sarvi's deposition. How harmful could this have been? Sarvi's obviously trying, I mean, I've tried to read the deposition, tried to follow what he was trying to say. He obviously was claiming his own innocence. Hard to reconcile with some of the more objective evidence, but the trier of fact has said, I don't believe it.
But the trier of fact.
He said it's essentially no probative value.
Mm. Well,
that's very different, of course.
Yeah. I thought he said it was cumulative.
He did. Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is that I believe that the standard can't be a subjective standard. It has to be an objective one. If you're reviewing whether inadmissible testimony was not let in, I think the standard is pretty clear. It has to be objective. It can't be bootstrapped by the comments of the judge, or you'd never get an appeal in a bench trial. A judge could always clean that up by simply saying, well, now that I look at it, it wouldn't have mattered to me anyway.
What's wrong with that?
Well, there's plenty wrong with it in terms of, I think you have to have an objective standard as to whether that would have materially affected the outcome of the case.
Well, but if, I mean, district judges as triers of fact say all the time that evidence that's of questionable admissibility or evidence that's been proffered wouldn't have made any difference to me. Right?
I understand they say that.
Mm-hmm. But are you saying that we're supposed to second guess their fact finding on that?
I think he did not make that statement weighing that evidence. I think as fact finder, you have to look at this objectively and see whether, as on an objective standard, someone could have looked at that testimony and simply said it wouldn't have mattered.
I understand that if it's a jury trial, but if it's the same person. Frankly, there is some uncertainty about exactly what the judge meant. I've read what he said. Let me give you the hypothetical that's a nice, clear explanation. This evidence from Sarvey's deposition is offered. The judge reads it, says, let's say erroneously under 804B1, I'm excluding it. But having read it, it wouldn't make any difference to me.
But he didn't say that.
I know. Suppose he did. Would that pretty much insulate it from review?
I'd like to say no, but it might. But
I think you should say no. You should say no because look, it's so facile, right? You say I've excluded it, but you know, I don't want to be reversed on that. So I add that, well, I wouldn't have believed
it. It's not too different from the line I heard before about the appellate court and the argument previous.
Well, and I would just say it seems to me to complete the circle, you would be looking at whether the finding of fact that this was pertinent to was clearly erroneous, and you would be seeing whether there was some error in deciding to refuse to consider certain evidence. If you just say the evidence is cumulative and it isn't, then there's a problem.
The other problem with that, we also raised in the brief, was based on my declaration, that not had that evidence been admitted, we would have put a case on, because I stopped putting the case on, as we didn't have to put a case on at that point. I would have had to put a case on to put that testimony in. And that did affect my trial strategy. So, I mean, that's in part the other answer to your question, Judge.
Okay, why don't you save the rest of your time and we'll...
That's fine. Thank you.
...and we'll listen to the government. We'll hear from the government. Mr. Histon?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Clifford Heistad and I represent the United States in this case. The district court in this case did not abuse its discretion by excluding from its own consideration the hearsay statement that was offered by Edward Sarvey in the CFTC deposition.
I mean, the CFTC has an incentive to nail them, explain on Sarvey, and, cross-examine him and so on. He babbles on. But why wouldn't that be admissible, especially in a bench trial? I'm not sure how it would work in a jury trial. It seemed kind of be awkward, but in a bench trial, why not admit that evidence?
Are you asking me how the CFTC...
The government could say, well, you know, this lawyer who, for the CFTC, he didn't ask good questions, you know, you really can't trust this. That would be fine, but in the absence of that, if it looks like effective, you know, conscientious cross-examination, why not admit it?
We maintain that it was not only not effective cross-examination, but that it was not cross-examination at all. You'll have to remember...
We've read the transcript. I mean, I'm looking
at
Judge Derhigian's actual ruling, which we might as well start with, before the trial, which shows up at page 3 of the appendix to the appellant's brief. And he does not, before the trial, exclude this evidence for any of the reasons that you're talking about. First of all, he reviews your arguments, and he essentially decides that he doesn't care whether the CFTC and the Department of Justice are the same party. I take this as kind of, let's assume for the sake of argument, they are. But he says Sklena has not shown that the CFT had a similar motive to develop Sklena's, testimony, and gives these factors from Feldman, and he just says civil proceedings and criminal proceedings are different, thus Sarvey's deposition testimony is not admissible. So that's the only thing. And I actually am very troubled by this motive thing, since, as I was suggesting, I can see plenty of circumstances where the stakes for the government, the motive, the incentive, would be far less in proceeding number one than in proceeding number two. But anybody who knows anything about fines or other sorts of monetary sanctions knows that there's a rough equivalence from a deterrence standpoint. You can have a huge fine that will be deterrent or lose your livelihood altogether, just as you can spend some time in prison. They are substitutes to a certain degree for one another. So I don't know that this case is the one where the motives are different.
I think the motives were very much different, and I'd like to explain why. In the CFTC case, which, as you know, is a civil case, their deposition was a search for facts. As in most civil depositions, they're asking a lot of questions. They're giving
they're
Mr. Sarvey.
They're searching for facts for the love of knowledge. They're searching for facts because they want to nail these guys.
I'd like to draw a distinction between the examination that the government would do at trial and the examination that the CFTC did at the deposition, which I think is really the heart of the issue here. I think this is what Judge Duryagin was saying when he talked about the difference between the civil.
One looks at the deposition. All the questions are by these government investigators. They don't seem to be friendly.
Indeed, they were not friendly. They were skeptical. They had filed a civil complaint against him. This was an adversary proceeding.
Right, it was adversary. So what was missing from it?
Follow-up questions. What was missing were targeted, focused questions that put Mr. Sarvey to the test.
You see, that would apply even if there had been a prior criminal proceeding. Now you're saying that the test should be that we should grade the interrogator, and if the person does a great job and follows up well, then it'll come in under 804B1. And if the person fails to follow up in ways that you would have or somebody else would have, then it doesn't come in. But that's not what the rule says. I'm looking at the rule. You just have to have an opportunity. That's the language of the rule. And similar motive. So even if they fell down in the job, in your estimation, maybe they did. I'm not going to guess about that. But they certainly had an opportunity and similar motive.
I'm not saying they fell down on the job. What I'm saying is they had a
but
very different.
But you just did say they fell down on
no,
the job.
I'm saying they had a different job.
Properly, and
they had a different job. Their job was to, as in all civil litigation, collect as many facts as they could.
You're going back to what I have often heard on the district court benches. Well, this wasn't a testimonial deposition, Judge. This was a discovery deposition.
Exactly right.
And there's exactly one kind of deposition under the civil rules of evidence. And it doesn't matter. If you took the deposition and the witness is no longer available, you can use it.
But the deposition of whatever sort is different from cross-examination in a criminal case, which is focused, which is targeted, which is designed to expose.
It doesn't read very differently at all.
But there's nothing in Rule 801 that says this rule does not apply if the earlier deposition was in a civil case and the later proceeding is a criminal action. The Rules Committee could have written such a rule, but they didn't.
That's true. Your Honor, I do believe that they were different for the reasons that I said, that there is a difference and a significant difference between cross-examination in an adversarial fact-finding setting and a open-ended, let's gather all of the facts sort of scenario that we can, that was the case in the civil case. I believe they're qualitatively different. I believe the judge ruled correctly, but I will concede that our bigger bone of contention is that we are not identical parties. That's the issue as we see it.
That's the one you want to hang your hat on.
No, I'd like to hang my hat on the strength of the evidence. And
what would you say if it were if it had been another U.S. attorney's office?
That would have been a harder sell.
That would be what?
That would be an impossible sell.
That would be a harder sell.
Because they're both under the Department of Justice. Right.
Correct. We would obviously not be making the different party argument if it was.
And your best case on that point is North and the difference between the congressional hearings and the independent counsel.
The best case for either side is that case, because nobody can point to, I am not aware of any holdings.
But the CFTC and the SEC work very, very closely with the Justice Department, right?
And here's an example for you.
They
suppose
do.
It had been an antitrust prosecution.
But not in this case.
and the person had been under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission for antitrust violations, and they had taken depositions because they were going to proceed under Section 5, and then somebody over across the street at the Department of Justice in the division said, we actually think you've uncovered criminal activity here, so we're going to proceed with the grand jury. Under your theory, the Federal Trade Commission testimony, if somebody dies now, isn't usable. And yet those two agencies work hand in glove, although FTC is technically an independent agency, and of course DOJ is DOJ.
You're talking about the DOJ Antitrust Division, is that what you're
talking
Yes.
about?
Yes. Well, you are right that they are very, very closely aligned. Their mission is the same. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the CFTC's mission, as it pertains to this case, are not so closely aligned.
I don't think that works, because actually sometimes even antitrust cases are prosecuted by U.S. Attorney's Offices, to the great distress, I might add, of the division. But it does happen.
I can tell you that in this case, we made an affirmative decision based on what we felt was proper and appropriate to not interfere with this deposition, to have no input.
Would this deposition of Sarvey, would this have been Brady material?
If he had exculpated Scalina, arguably it could have been, but as you see from my brief, I think that he rambled on incoherently.
Well, then you could get in real trouble, right? Because we have held, and it's certainly very important to you, that the only type of government information that is Brady material is information collected by some agency that can be considered part of the prosecution team, right? So if you say this is Brady material, that means you're acknowledging the CFTC in this proceeding was really part of the prosecutorial team.
I did not acknowledge that whatsoever.
No, you didn't.
I thought that you meant if I had the deposition, would I do? They were not part of the prosecution team in this case. CFTC was not.
It would not be unless you actually had it, but
so
it wouldn't
be. If the
CFTC
had given it to you, would it be Brady?
Yes.
Yeah.
If it was
but suppose that you knew about the CFTC investigation and you're asked for Brady material, but you haven't actually seen what the CFTC has done. But would you say you wouldn't have a duty to inquire into what they've done?
If they were part of the prosecution team, I would be
accountable.
Well,
no, that's the question. Are they part of the prosecution team?
Not in this case.
But under your theory, Mr. Husted, it sounds like the Skilling case, for example, should have been decided in about one page, just saying the teams were different, the SEC investigations of the Enron executives were separate, and we didn't see that at all there. Instead, we see a very, very careful consideration of the details there.
In Enron, they worked hand in glove. There was a prosecution team there that was absent in this case.
With the SEC? Because the SEC proceedings were also part of that decision.
I'm going to claim ignorance. I'm not well-versed in the intricacies of that working relationship.
Okay.
Let me change the subject. In your brief, you say that the real evidence against Scalina is that Sarvey was just a broker. And so if Scalina bought contracts from Sarvey, as obviously he did, these had to be customer contracts. Now, so Sarvey didn't do any trading on his own account?
Sarvey did do trading. He was a dual trader.
Why do you keep calling him a broker? Look, when they use the term broker, they call him a broker. That doesn't mean he doesn't do trading on his own account, right? They don't say, well, he's a broker plus trader. They just say he's a broker, yeah, but he does stuff on his own account. So why is this such killing evidence against Scalina? How do we know that Sarvey didn't, this was the most chaotic day in the history of commodities trading, something. How do we know that Sarvey didn't get frightened? You know, prices are dropping. He sells a bunch of stuff to Scalina, and Sklana thinks this is great. He doesn't know whether it's customers or what. He just knows this is great. Everything happening very rapidly. And then Sklana decides, wait a second, I'm too invested in this. It's too much risk. So I'm going to give a third of this back to Sarvey. I don't see anything in that that signifies guilt.
Sklana, it would be absolutely irrational and unheard of for Edward Sarvey to hold 2,474 contracts that he was required to sell at the price of 111.065 when the market was trading substantially higher than that. There is no reason for him to do that unless he wanted to confer a benefit onto Mr. Sklana. And more importantly, when Mr. Sklana gets the offer to buy these contracts,
well, look, these prices are changing by the second.
But they were changing by the second.
He's frightened, and he unloads this stuff at a lower price than the market price because he doesn't want to be stuck with this stuff when the price plummets.
But the price has been consistently going up for the past 5 minutes. I agree with you that in the very beginning of the trading day.
The past 5 minutes, and let's see what the next 5 minutes holds.
Really volatile market.
It had been volatile.
Maybe it was. There's at least a bet that it would continue to go up for the next 5 minutes as opposed to plunge back down again. Things were bouncing around.
But he held on to them for 6 minutes, and then the price was substantially higher. When Sklana,
so that's really your evidence, right?
The evidence
is the implausibility of someone selling for less than the market price.
That's part of it.
You wouldn't sell your own stuff. You might sell out your customers, but you wouldn't sell your own stuff.
Exactly.
That's
right.
Is the theory here that Sarvey was just trying to do a favor for a buddy who had a rough time?
I think that there were two aspects of it. The trial court heard that Sklana had busted out. He'd been wiped out the month before in trades that he had done with Sarvey. I don't know whether the court found that was a reason for convicting him, but certainly that was part of the information mix. But not only that, let's not forget the kickback. It's not just that Sklana had to know that Sarvey was not going to sell $2 million worth of contracts that were guaranteed losers from his own account. What happened here was Sarvey sold the accounts to Sklana and then immediately bought back 385 of those contracts. Now, if he was actually just trying to sell off in a panic, fearful for the price vacillations, all these contracts, why would he then immediately, within the second...
No, you're missing the point about Sklana getting worried that he had bought too much of this stuff and wanting to get rid of it quickly, and he gives it back to Sarvey.
But at the same price,
that's the
right?
defense theory.
Yeah.
But didn't he sell it back at the same price?
He sold it at a slightly higher price, but still less than the prevailing market price. In other words, he converted an immediate benefit to Sarvey of $400,000 the second after he made these purchases. This is one way that we know...
In hindsight.
Well, based on the
7-minute hindsight, maybe, or whatever, but hindsight.
Well, based on the testimony also of the other traders who testified
at
trial, that they had done...
At the moment he sells the stock back, the price hasn't gone up to the point where eventually these things are sold at. So it's...
The price was above both prices at that time. In other words, it was irrational for Sklana to conclude anything other than...
I think you have a good case, although it seems pretty thin for a criminal case. I don't understand. There are civil remedies in this business are extremely powerful, right?
Your Honor, I can see that I'm not a...
person's whole career, his whole livelihood.
It was a challenging but worthwhile case.
Business. I don't know why you have to press criminal charges.
Because commodities traders should not be allowed to steal millions of dollars from their customers.
Yes, I know, but they have very powerful... Why does the government want to use the criminal law when it has extraordinarily powerful civil remedies? What sense does that make?
Because we were separate and apart from the CFTC, which had its own agenda.
Well, that's a ridiculous answer. You're separate and apart. The federal government is just a collection of hostile states, right?
No,
so you do what you do, they do what they do. The thought that you might coordinate and have one agency that has the appropriate remedies deal with the problem, that's foreign to this balkanized executive branch thinking.
No, Your Honor. There is cooperation. It just was not here.
And criminal and prison does have a kind of qualitative difference to it.
It does.
A deterrent in the government's view, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Mr. Histed.
So, well, before you sit down, did Mr. Sklena report? I thought his report date was extended to January 4.
He did report.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Durkin?
I was hoping you were going to ask Mr. Heisted where he served prior to being a U.S. attorney, which was with the CFTC, which belies kind of their whole argument.
I'm sorry. You'll have to start over.
He was a lawyer with the CFTC before he came to the U.S. attorney's office.
That's not going to convince.
I understand that. But the separation here is an argument is absurd, totally absurd. The fact that this was a civil fact-finding deposition is also totally absurd, because that's where I get in to the prior Board of Trade proceeding. The government, the CFTC government, and the Department of Justice knew full well all the facts before that CFTC case was brought. They had the transcript of the Office of Internal Audits, I think it's called, was huge, and it was a mini-trial of this case. In fact, I argued, you can see in the record, that exactly what took place in front of Judge Deryagian was the same case that took place in front of the Board of Trade investigators and audits. And I share your concern about why they would bring a criminal case under those circumstances. If I don't profess to understand the complete law and economic theory, but it would seem to me he participated fully in the marketplace. He went right ahead. He didn't refuse to go ahead with the inspector.
You don't see a value to prison as a deterrence to undermining the integrity of the market?
Not in this case. And that's
what
I argue.
That's a different question.
Of course, there's always a deterrent. But the problem with this case, and I argued this to Judge Deryagian, is there was no evidence of any concerted activity here. There was chaos. It was 7 minutes where the whole world fell apart.
There was some evidence. You disagreed with it.
I disagree with it, but my point was, how does that happen in 7 minutes? This was not like the other cases the U.S. Attorney's Office had
brought. How was it that, if I recall correctly, at 7:30, Mr. Sklena had $58,000 of equity in his account.
Right.
Is that right?
I think that's right.
And he then was trading on the margin of, by my calculation, fluctuations in the value of $230 million worth of notes.
That's the kind of trader he was, and there was evidence that he was. You know, whether he's a smart trader.
He made $2 million in either 7 minutes or 14 minutes.
He made $1.6 million.
After the sales back.
Right.
Okay. And was basically playing with his clearinghouse's money, right?
That's right. But there was evidence in the record that was the type of trader he was. He was known as what they call a shooter. There were several people testified to that. It doesn't make him smart, but it doesn't make him a criminal. But
okay, well,
thank you
very much, Mr. Durkin and Mr. Heister. And the court will be in recess.
Thank you.